Council Organizational Committee to order. Today, we are excited to have City Attorney Lindsay Olson here to give us an update on immigration services. And this is, as we all know, a program that's in its infancy. We talked about it a bit last year in the beginning of the year. And so in advance of this meeting, we had a conversation about, you know, we know that this is probably not a completed program, but just to check in to understand where we're at on the timeline. So that would be, we're really excited to hear about that. I know it's a priority for the council as well. And then we will also get an update from the Office of Financial Empowerment. As far as timelines go, I know the council has a obligation at noon, so we are going to try to plan to wrap up by 11:15, if that's possible.
We're probably all going to the same place.
Okay.
Think. Yeah.
So, great. So that's just as a guidepost. So with that, we will welcome City Attorney Lindsay Olson. It's great to have you here today.
Thank you, Council President Brenlund. Good morning, council members. I just have a few slides to guide our discussion, but by no means are we going to stick to a script on that or anything. I'm going to bear with me because I'm flipping slides and talking at the same time. So this first slide is just a quick summary of kind of where we're at, how we got there, and everybody knows we allocated $100,000 originally from 2018. We didn't completely figure out what the focus was going to be for it that year, so it was rolled over to 2019 so we could continue that because everyone was in agreement that that was still an important thing that we wanted to pursue. We've switched the name. We didn't have a definite name for the program. It kind of began with the idea just generally of, I think, more intentionally figuring out how are we supporting immigrant populations within St. Paul. And we have not, as a city, had a specific office or program that has focused in on those populations. And this is the beginning of that, I think, intentional dialogue. And I say it really broadly because when we were given this opportunity to do this work, as you know, we didn't have a lawyer with any immigration background in our office, and so we really entered into this as a huge learning opportunity to figure out, you know, what do we need to focus on as a city? What should the program do? What is this going to look like? And where we came out is, the money that we entered into this JPA with Ramsey County for is one piece of it, and then hiring this attorney and really building something that is going to work for St. Paul is the other piece of that. And the first thing I want to talk about is the JPA and the VERA grant that we're working with Ramsey County on. So we, you all committed, and the mayor's office committed, that $50,000 would go to the VERA, what is now the VERA program with Ramsey County. And what that is, Ramsey County allocated $100,000 through their board to go to removal defense. And at the time when we started talking with Elizabeth Tolsman over there, they were moving through a little bit faster than we were, but we came together and pooled the money, got to the JPA, both agreed we wanted to pursue the VERA grant. Their grant focuses in on removal defense. Now, removal defense is only one thing that is important around immigration services, but that's what that money will do, and they do a matching grant of $100,000, and so right now we have $250,000 total, and the process that we're in right now with them is putting together the RFP to look for what legal services organization will actually do those services. And as you can see on the bottom, we just have a couple of things that are priorities with that, which is just making sure that the messaging goes out that those specific funds are for removal defense, and so people are already calling and wondering about that money. And the other thing is about making sure that we're getting priority intake for Ramsey County and St. Paul people in that money. So we want to ensure it's used the way that we intended. So we also did hire a immigration attorney, and we're calling the program at this point Immigrant Services Program because I want to focus more on people rather than immigration, because we're not, as you know, we're not representing individual clients. We're not doing immigration law in the way that a private practitioner would do that. That's not the we don't have that mandate in the office. That's not what we intend. So we're moving more towards, you know, what is going to be the service, what is going to be the program. Edmundo Lijo is who we hired. He will start on June 3rd. He is, I can't wait for you to meet him because he is fantastic. We had such a great pool of candidates. It was an incredibly hard process for us because we had such great people. It's kind of sort of the perfect problem as an employer to have. And he stood out amongst a ton of great people, and we're just really excited to bring him on because he's going to be, I think he's going to, he has a passion for this. He's leaving a 25-year practice. He's wrapping up his practice to come and work for the city and begin this work. And right away from the minute he walked in the room, he really impressed us with his knowledge and just the depth of his passion for this work. And I won't read you his bio here, but you have the handouts. You can see what his bio is. He previously was an assistant county attorney as well in Texas, and he spent, you know, the last 25 years working in immigration law here. He's amongst people in the practice really considered a go-to mentor around St. Paul and in the Twin Cities. So he's very well known, and we really felt that he could work with a variety of all our immigrant populations really well. So I have a couple slides looking at what he will do. And this, again, really high level right now, because our intention in bringing him in is to really have him as our subject matter expert to begin a real focused dialogue with the council, with the mayor's office, with stakeholders within the city and out in the community about what we need to change in the city, what we need to do in focusing in on the community of St. Paul. And so we're going to start with a lot of information gathering, meetings, discussion to really form, you know, what we think are the focuses. We have a basic idea. There are a lot of things that really came to the surface in interviews too, and we can talk more about that if you have questions. We certainly have ideas, and I know that Mundo has some really great ideas as well, but we want to make sure that it continues to be a dialogue and that we build this program into something that will increase trust between the immigrant populations in the city and be something really meaningful for us. So, any questions on where we're at with Immigrant Services Program or Edmundo or anything?
Ms. Naker?
Thank you. Ms. Olson, how will we know, I guess, in a year from now or so, whether or not the addition of this additional city attorney to the team has been a good investment?
Well, I think, you know, the intention is twofold, you know, internal to the city, really looking at practices that we have in the city and how they're affecting different equity outcomes. And so I think, you know, in identifying some of those and looking at how we can change internal practices, for instance, you know, how we're applying zoning, how we're doing code enforcement, things like that, those things can all have adverse effects on, you know, different immigrant populations. And we, again, we haven't done that intentional work. So I think one way would be just in seeing those changes in our policies and you know, the reflection back of what people's experiences are. And the other way, I think, is through the engagement that we're going to have with the community. One of the main things that we want to try to do is have Edmundo out there working with people and really feeling like there's a consistent engagement on people's needs within the specific communities. There are initiatives that we are interested, and again, there's no, because he's not here yet, and we haven't really talked about how that program will look in terms of what are the city's priorities going to be in the program and how are we going to execute those. But one of the things that came out in interviews was that for the percentage of immigrant populations in St. Paul, the percentage of those populations that are citizens is a smaller percentage than like cities with like populations around the country. And that was a really interesting fact for us, because we had already started talking about programs and looked at programs. We went and visited New York City's program, and they have, I mean, they're a huge city, obviously, huge immigrant populations, very mature programs, being a connector and servicing their populations. But they have programs like citizenship and libraries, and some really targeted citizenship programs. And we had already been looking at those programs as one of the possible initiatives for the money that was set aside. And hearing that fact that we have, you know, percentage-wise less citizens, really we sort of keyed in on that as, oh, there's a real opportunity there for us to grow that. And in talking with these immigration practitioners, you know, there are a lot of really horrible things happening to a lot of people. And again, you know, as we started talking about this, you know, we can't throw money to every single individual person's defense, or, you know, there's so many people having a lot of really bad challenges. But citizenship is a way to get at, you know, keeping them here and making them permanent parts of our community. So those are just a few of the things that come to mind. I think that I could better answer your question probably, you know, 6 months, maybe even 3 months in, when we have, you know, we've had some of these initial conversations and a little more planning about, you know, how this will take shape.
Mr. Tolbert.
Yeah, I just want to say one of my biggest concerns when I think we all wanted to do something last year in terms of helping our immigrant and refugee populations. And my biggest concern originally is that we were just going to throw money at it to throw money at it because we didn't know what to do. But and I know there's still a lot to be ironed out. And when you get an expert, he's got to be one of the leaders in the immigration field, probably in the country, based on his resume. But I think that this is actually a really good use and deliberate use of that resource, and we'll be able to fill in what we wanted to do. And that's exciting because, like I said, my biggest concern over this was that we all wanted to do something. We just didn't know what to do. And I didn't want to just toss money at it because we didn't know what to do. But this seems to be the mix that I was looking for when we allocated that money last year and then in the budget this year. So I look forward, and to get someone of this caliber is pretty impressive.
Yes, Council. We're very excited about him, and I think you guys really, I mean, I wanted to have him here today, but we're trying not to pull him into every single thing before he actually starts here. So thanks.
That was my first question. It's like, bring him to the meeting.
I know, I wanted to. I really wanted to.
I think it's a good point, though, too. I mean, a lot of we often struggle with that conversation about allocating resources before we have a plan, and then we need resources to make a plan. And so just finding that, threading the needle and making sure that we can continue to move forward with things. And I think in this case, getting those resources lined up so that we knew that we could move forward was the right path. And I mentioned at the onset of this, when in the next 3 months or 4 months, just kind of continuing to check in like this, I think is helpful for all of
us. Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to do that. I think it's great too, because it helps us to, you know, see that we're all on the same page and everyone's comfortable with where we're at. And we wanted to be really intentional too with this money. I think we were excited about the opportunity, but I really want to make sure that we're setting up something meaningful, and that it's, you know, it's sort of, you know, I don't want to put a Band-Aid on like a sucking chest wound. I really want us to figure out a way for there to be sustainable services and coordination. And I think in looking at the other cities that have really successful programs that have been meaningful to those immigrant populations, it's about the ongoing dialogue, about connection to services, about feeling like allowing those those communities to feel like, hey, there's something in the city that is for us, where we increase trust. We know we can come to our government and they're going to listen to us. They're going to hear that we have different experiences. They're going to hear we have these challenges. You know, they're facing things like wage theft, and I know that you guys know that, but it's also about talking with them about how do we get at those things? How do we help you to, you know, to feel safe in your community, things like that, where, you know, being more intentional about addressing those issues and helping them to feel included in St. Paul. And I think that's where it feels so right to me with the focus of the council and the administration. It's just...
Well, and I, Ms. Nelson, I think has a question. I just wanted to say from Mr. Busseri, who got in just a moment late, it looks like we're talking about the Neighborhood Justice Program, but we are finishing up conversation about the Immigrant Services Program. So in case you were like, what? That is what's going on. So we're just wrapping up the one conversation on the slide and move forward to the next section. Ms. Nelson.
Thank you. It's really helpful, and I appreciate seeing the progress we've made on this. This was something I was excited to support in the budget. I know this is really early, so this will all be refined over the next few months as we do the inventory. I totally get wanting to take stock of what already exists in and outside of our community to make sure we're making the right value add with this. Mine is more of a comment or thing to build on is that so there's a part of this that talks about improving current services, language barriers, understanding, translating, and interpreting, mm-hmm. and things that are starting to get, like, I see them more as administrative issues about inclusive governance that should be happening across, like, our council office, across other. So how can we kind of scale that work up beyond just this attorney's position? Because I feel like that almost gets into, like, something categorically, that deserves capacity beyond just, you know, this one position or this one growing, like, unit. And it is a value that to me is central, and I would like to figure out how we can get that beyond just this one office. Like, just because it serves immigrant communities doesn't mean it's the only one responsible for being multilingual and inclusive. Mm-hmm. And I often, as a council office, just, like, try to figure out how to get translation at my events and things like that. And I know we have some city resources, but how can we kind of, like, connect those pieces better so that it's, like, comprehensive and across the city? Is this making sense? It's just kind of like a reaction to...
Yes. No, Council Member, I think that's a really good point. And I think that my sense is that it's that and then probably more that we don't know. And that's been our feeling. Like, once we started talking about this and looking into it, we felt like here's the iceberg at the top of the water, and then here's what it is underneath, and we're not sure what that all looks like yet. And we didn't want to start doing a ton of that work until we hired somebody. And you're right, it shouldn't be just this attorney that's running one program and this one person who's trying to do all of whatever it might take for the city. But I think where I'm at right now is I still feel like we don't entirely know what we don't know. And I want him to get in here and start looking at things, working with the departments. I think rulemaking is probably another one of those areas where we need to take a look at not only what the city's process is across departments and how are we making rules and how are we doing those things, but, you know, what are the equity effects? And you're right, it does. It's more than just what the city attorney's office would do. But I feel like this is a good jumping off point for us to start doing that critical review. And once we have a better idea of what we might be looking at, where problem areas lie, you know, bringing that back in here to have those conversations. Here's what we found. You know, we're going to be able to give you some, you know, some form to some of these issues to try to figure out, well, what resources do we actually need? And, you know, and where should the focus points be? And that those are the critical conversations that I feel like we really need to have in the next several months.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to keep an eye on the time. But yes,
I just want to go back very briefly to the Immigrant Services Program update slide 2. Can you just, this is also in line with just making sure that the investments we made are paying off. What it sounds like the county budgeted $100,000 for matching with the VERA grant, mm-hmm. and then we added $50,000. Mm-hmm. And then VERA matched the county's $100,000 essentially. So now we're at $250,000. Mm-hmm. So what did our additional $50,000 get for the city of St. Paul in terms of services that wouldn't have been achieved if it had just been the county going in with Vera?
Sure. Well, I think it's the city specifically giving those funds that we made sure in the JPA language that money would be allocated to people living in St. Paul. And so that was one of the things. One of the concerns that we had in talking with them when we were figuring out, are we going to do this? How is it going to look? Is, hey, you know, we get, you guys serve all of Ramsey County, and while St. Paul's a big part of that, it's not necessarily that. And so we didn't want to give the money to the pool to just have it go to whoever, however. You know, we wanted to make sure that was that we understood the priority of allocation. We understood the money that St. Paul is allocating would be for citizens, residents of St. Paul. And so we're getting, you know, I don't mean this to sound the way it's going to sound, but whatever that money will buy. And I say that because in removal defense, you know, the actual legal services for that could be, you know, any variety of levels, just depending on the cases. One of the things we're working through right now is the RFP and really looking at, I think, you know, the scope of cases, how are we going to look at priority cases, things like that. So all those things aren't worked through yet in terms of the RFP. And I think, you know, we're aware that $50,000 is not, you know, it's not a whole lot in terms of legal services. But it is something. And so that's kind of back to the, you know, the conversation that we were having when the money was allocated was, you know, are we going to want to do that even though it's, you know, just making like a tiny dent and helping, you know, relatively few people in the scope of everybody who really needs help. But we are making sure that St. Paul is residents are receiving that money.
Ms. Prince.
I really appreciate your presentation, and I'm excited that Mr. Leho is going to be starting soon. One thing, I'm sensitive to the question that Ms. Naker asked about how we're going to know that this is working and how are we going to evaluate it. And I'm a little bit concerned, as I have been right along with hiring a staff person, that we've hired a solution before we've adequately defined the problem. And so I want to be able to get some real clarity on what we're doing here and how we can evaluate it. Because I think that I was supportive of the legal defense fund because I feel it's really consistent with the fact that we provide money to SMRLs because we recognize that tenants need defense and immigrants are a vital part of our community, and we recognize that we don't want them being deported. So I'm really clear on that, but I just want to say that I want to see some sharpening up of this work plan and how we will evaluate it sooner than later. So I just want to get that out there.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. I don't have a work plan for you today and didn't intend to have that because I think it would be disingenuous of us to prepare a work plan for our subject matter expert who's going to come in here and do that work. And we were very intentional in our hiring process about looking at candidates, although we had a ton of really great candidates, people who were focused on how they were going to build a program. And I think, you know, we wanted to get somebody in here who we felt could take the reins of that and guide the city to build something that is going to be meaningful for people. So I share that concern. I want it to be, you know, I think we all want it to be something meaningful, you know, and I just can't explain all of that to you today because we're not ready to do that yet. We still have to have a lot of conversations about it, but it's a priority, it's a process, and I'm happy to come back here whenever you want me to. So.
Mr. Tolbert.
Kind of off that point a little bit, I would say a work plan is important, but at the same time, I think, unfortunately, I wish we could have a very prescribed position here, but we need this person to be very nimble because, mm-hmm. unfortunately, this administration has made it every day, every hour, there's something new. And if you follow immigration law across the country and the realities from what I read of people on the ground, this administration's throwing curveballs every single day. So we need this person to be able to be nimble and help communities and react to that. So we want a general work plan, but to have a very prescribed thing like this is what you'll be doing over the next year is not, I mean, how it's realistically playing out. Well, we have Trump in the White House, basically, is every day is something new. And that's why I think having someone with this experience is so important, because they know the law. He should know the laws like the back of his hand, the real laws, and then be able to react as the laws and the policies of this administration changes.
Yes.
And so I would caution against being too prescriptive in their job role. I mean, obviously you want to hold someone accountable for the work that they're going to do, but they need to be able to react so we can best represent all the people of St. Paul.
Right. Thank you. Okay. Well, I just have two quick slides on the Neighborhood Justice Program. I know we've talked to all of you individually about this program, too, and we're really excited to do presentations in your wards along with you. And here's the schedule just for review, and I hope all of you are planning to make it. And then I wanted to give you our implementation timeline for the Neighborhood Justice Program, and we're pretty much on track right now for how we're moving forward. All our stakeholder conversations are scheduled, and that's going to be a huge piece of getting, making sure that we're moving forward in a way that's, you know, that the community feels good about. And we've been all the way along gathering volunteer sign-ups, and we've partnered with Dispute Resolution Center and the Circle for Peacemaking, and we're very excited about them. And as you probably know, they have done a lot of work already within St. Paul. They're doing this work on the ground, just in, you know, neighborhood conflict resolution types of ways. And I'm really excited about how they're going to partner with us, because we wanted to make sure we were bringing in diverse groups of folks to sit on these community panels and really representing the communities. So we're still on track for having our first go live date be September, and I'm happy to come, you know, back and update you after we've begun that work sometime in the fall too. So,
Mr. Vasuri and then Ms. Nicker.
So this is a great initiative and we love it. I want to know, when you say September 3rd is the live date, is that for citywide or certain parts of the city?
So we're going to start with pilot sites. I'm hoping to get two pilot sites, but it depends on how many volunteers we would have trained by that time. So if we can get two, we haven't decided on the pilot sites yet. We're going to have that conversation with Dispute Resolution Center, and I think we need to also work with police a little bit and pulling where are we seeing cases from. So we're still in the midst of that discussion, but we wanted to start with two sites to see how we can, you know, make sure that we've refined the process before we go live citywide and make sure we have enough volunteers to cover where we need to cover. So what we decided about that was that we would take cases from all over the city at the two pilot sites until we can do them, because this really is a neighborhood-based program. So I went back and forth about that a little bit, but I don't want certain communities to feel like, why don't we have this in our neighborhood? And so we want to be able to take those cases, and then, you know, I would anticipate pretty shortly, unless there are some big things we need to iron out, that we could move into other sites as we train enough folks to do that.
Just one more question. Yeah. I see that most of the funding on your list is grants. Is there any money coming from the city?
So we are seeking several grants. The city money that we have right now, I mean, yes, it's coming from my department. So basically, right now we're using money that we have. We saved some money on a transcription program. I'm planning to be able to reallocate that money to support. And the main cost that we have right now is administration and training with Dispute Resolution Center. So, and we don't know exactly we had a list of from them of their costs, but we don't know exactly how much we're going to end up paying, you know, over time yet. Depends on, how often we're training groups and that kind of thing. So I have not, and I don't plan to ask for any other specific budget money this year for this. My intention is to be able to pay invoices from them ongoing. We're also hiring a staff person, a paralegal. We're in the process of interviews right now to hire an additional paralegal that will take over much of the administration of the program. And so where I see this kind of ending up is a public-private partnership where we'd probably always be requesting some type of private assistance for different aspects of the program. But as it matures, we feel like we'd be able to take over most of the administration.
Thank you.
Ms. Tinker.
Thank you. First of all, I love the diagonal timelines. Whoever came up with that, totally brilliant. Gives you a sense of forward momentum. Visually attractive. Awesome. Second of all, budget-wise, I had a similar question to Councilmember Busseri. Just wondering, what is the total budget? And I assume from what you just said that none of these grants, not to put it this way, but are make or break, but we would like to have. So it's not like
yes,
this will happen regardless. But what is the total budget then for the program?
Well, the programmatic costs are primarily the administration training costs. And we put out an RFP, and we got two responses. And we went with Dispute Resolution Center, although we told them they had their I don't have it with me, but I believe theirs was something around $200,000, what they thought it would cost to do administration per year. We thought that was high. And I felt like in their proposal they kind of threw in the kitchen sink, like, here are all the great things that we could do. And so when we had discussions with them after, we said, well, we don't know that we need all of these things, but here's what we really want. They also have a grant, a current grant. So where we've ended up right now is that they're willing to, like, they're coming to all of the neighborhood conversations, and they're going to run circles at those conversations to show people what this looks like. And that was something they really wanted to do. And we said, we just aren't in a position to be able to pay for that service. We love the idea. We just aren't in a position to be able to pay for that service. And they said, hey, well, we actually have a grant to do this work, and we could come and do it. And so where we got to is they're committed to being our partner. They love the idea of this work as well. And they wanted to come and do this. And so they're going to use their grant funds to do this work at the community conversations. And then we're going to look how we're moving forward with the agreement is that they're going to basically bill us for services as we go along. And that will help us departmentally to be able to budget this. So I can give you a better idea next year of, you know, where we are at cost-wise, but we're being really conscious of costs, and I think once we train this paralegal internally too, and have that person being able to do a lot of the coordination, that we're going to see it's going to kind of go up, and then it's going to kind of go down and level off is where I think we're going to end up.
Ms. Dalton.
My question is about the community engagement work coming up. I'm really excited for that, and I'll be going to the one that's in my part of town.
Great.
And my thought ahead of those that I'm really interested to get your ideas on is how we can make those meaningful to shaping the program. Like, mm-hmm. What do you need to know the most from our community to help this be successful? How can we help facilitate some of that at or around these meetings? There's just a lot of expertise in existing models, and we have to blend that with our residents, and like there's a lot of complexity within that. So I'm just mm-hmm. interested to hear how you're thinking about it, up going into them, so we can make them really, really impactful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the strengths of the conversations is going to be the various perspectives that are going to be there. I'm assuming there are going to be people that are skeptical of it there, as well as people that are going to be excited about understanding what it's about. So to me, one of the main things that we're going to be doing is educating people as to what this is, that it isn't just a way to allow people to, quote, get out free, you know, not have consequences. I mean, this is actually about consequences, but in a different way that, you know, leads to lower recidivism rates and, you know, more safety in the communities. And so we're preparing to talk about what the research has shown, what other programs have shown. Dispute Resolution is going to be there to talk about the work that it's done and the results that it's had. And I think we're hoping to dialogue with residents on, you know, what are the specifics that they're seeing in their neighborhood? Where are the concerns in those specific spaces? Because what we've seen so far with other resident conversations that we have in the justice arena is, you know, all these neighborhoods are different. They're, I mean, as you know, and so whatever the concerns and the focuses are and the types of crimes that are specific to the neighborhoods, all different. And so as we're building, you know, what is going to make sense for this community, I really think we should take it space by space. And if it's something where we're really hearing, hey, you know, great, you have this list, but here are the crimes that we see a lot of in our neighborhood, and you know, what are you going to be doing about these things that we're seeing all the time? Are these going to be crimes you're taking? Something like that. You know, we can always look to adjust how we're doing administration in a particular ward so that we can really be addressing what people are feeling.
Great. And Mr. Basuri had a follow-up.
Yep. Just is there other cities near that are doing this program that we can use as a reference?
Good question. We didn't look at Minneapolis's program specifically. I know that they do work with dispute resolution. And their program is not as formalized as this program. We, in prep to build this program, we visited a couple of cities that really started this type of program. We went to San Francisco and then Yolo County, which is outside Sacramento, about an hour or so outside of San Francisco. We visited both of their programs, and they're similar but not the same. Yolo County actually built their program off of San Francisco, but it became something very different. San Francisco runs more of a panel type of program, where Yolo runs a circle program with a facilitator. And so it was a really good opportunity for us to see two really mature and successful programs with a lot of information gathering behind them, and then contrast, you know, what we felt we wanted to bring in here. We also did a visit to the community courts of New York City, and they have various types of programs, including some that are, they don't call it neighbor, they in California they call it neighborhood court, and we felt like we didn't want to say the word court because it's not really a court, and so we wanted to get away from that word. But they have similar programs in New York City as well that do dispute resolution. Yeah, so we did look at several successful programs.
I appreciate you taking the trauma that most people have on the cognitive of the word court and stuff like that. So thank you.
Yeah.
And I just know I mentioned earlier the time constraints because I know you have to be somewhere at, like we do at noon, but I don't know if OFE does. And so I want to make sure that they
sure.
have as much
yep.
time as
Absolutely.
They need. So if we have more, I mean, clearly there's interest in this. You did take a lap to all the council offices. And if there's follow-up questions, we can route them through Holly. Holly can get information. And this is really exciting. And I love the ward-by-ward meetings and the opportunity for us to engage our community members who've been like, when are we going to start doing this stuff? So it is great. And I'll give you the final word if you'd like it, but we're going to move on to the OFE presentation.
Okay, wonderful.
Great. Thank you so much for being
Thank
here
you.
Today. Yep, we appreciate it. And as you can tell, we'll probably be inviting you back.
Sounds good. I can't wait.
Welcome. It used to be there was only two chairs up there, and so when three people presented, it was a little awkward, and now you, like, are owning it. It looks great. And I'll just let you know, these are kind of microphones that want you to talk right into them, so it helps if they're pointed right at your lips. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having us, Councilmember Ben Moen and council members. So today we're going to give a brief overview of where we're at with the Office of Financial Empowerment. At the end of this week, we will be at day 60. So you're getting an early update, and there's stuff that is emergent, and there's some things that have landed, and we hope we can be in conversation with you in that space. So a little bit about the Office of Financial Empowerment. There's three staff members right now. So myself, Ikram, and Kirsten, as they sort of talk about their different pieces, you know, they'll introduce themselves a little bit more. So right now there's a movement toward financial empowerment at the city level. And as you see here on the slide, there's a number of other cities who have Office of Financial Empowerment. And this is not by any means all of them, but some of the originators from the city of San Francisco to Denver to New York City. And there's a national intermediary called the Cities for Financial Empowerment Fund, who we also worked with over the past year before we got here. Actually, Ikram worked with them. But to really help guide the design, you know, of Office of Financial Empowerment and what some of those designs have looked like across the nation are, you know, college savings accounts or children's savings accounts. So up here we have the K2C, the Kindergarten to College program in San Francisco. Others are focused on Bank On. Bank On is looking at those residents who don't have checking and savings accounts or what have been labeled as the unbanked. And sort of different programmatic features there. Others is scaling, you know, free tax prep clinics in the city of Newark. Then Mayor Booker, he started financial empowerment centers, which were sort of one-stop hubs in each of the wards, you know, throughout Newark. And that was, again, focused on free one-on-one financial counseling. And other cities like St. Louis have taken John Hope Bryant's model called Operation Hope, which is just a different financial counseling, you know, model, and scaled that up across the city. So I just want to give a little bit of context to what's happening around the nation and then sort of contextualize it to show how we're going to be in alignment with some of that, but also, you know, different in others. So right now, the vision statement we're working with right now is we want to see a St. Paul it's an economic democracy that shares prosperity with all St. Paul residents. And what we mean by economic democracy is a more just, sustainable, democratic economy that equitably serves the people, people of the planet and place. And if we go to that next phrase there, shares prosperity, what we really mean is that St. Paul residents have equitable access and realization of both the economic and social benefits of living in St. Paul. So for us, we're trying to figure out how do we breathe life, you know, sort of into this vision. And for us, sort of our emerging OFE, Office of Financial Empowerment Results Framework, is right now we're working off of five results, and these are the conditions that we want to see, you know, living out, you know, day-to-day in St. Paul neighborhoods and among our city's residents. And quickly, you know, it's focused on financial health, so residents achieving financial health, St. Paul neighborhoods achieving community wealth. As we think about financial health, we really think about an individual's day-to-day financial system and how that functions for them and increases the likelihood of their financial resilience and opportunity. As we think about community wealth, we're thinking about how do we build just and equitable communities, you know, that promote local, you know, and broad-based ownership, that lift up cooperative and broad-based ownership, and that we you know, are guided by a set of values, you know, rooted in equity, culture, mutuality, you know, stewardship, and that community wealth is really looking at, is rooted in the belief that, you know, our economic systems must shift away from sort of these extractive models that take money out of our communities and move toward ones that are more regenerative. And we'll kind of highlight some of those pieces as we move forward. Result three is really around residents live in stable, safe, and affordable communities. Families with children living in St. Paul have a city that cares about their future, and that we have community members that are engaged in public decision making. So how will we know that we're successful? So this is the part where we're still sort of digging in, but we have a handout here. And on the backside, we have a whole slew of potential indicators, citywide indicators that, you know, are being developed. And these are just a draft, and we still have to go through a prioritization process, you know, there. But we do want to highlight just a few indicators that we know are jumping out, you know, with us right now. So one is looking at income inequality, you know, in the city of St. Paul. right? So we know the top 25% of the city earns 5.8 times the income of our lowest income residents. This, in fact, is the worst income inequality in the state and among the worst in the nation. So we have folks who are really, really wealthy, and we have really, really folks who don't have the resources and the financial security, you know, to live, you know, their everyday lives.
I'd be really interested to learn. Sometimes when we look at information like that, I think mm-hmm. about Ramsey County and St. Paul, and when you look at census tracts in poverty in St. Paul and Ramsey County versus Hennepin County and the size of Hennepin County, and, you know, like, I sometimes feel like it's challenging to compare apples to apples when you're looking at Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I don't know if there's any way to drill down a little bit further with that, because it's good to know, and I believe it, and I know we've got to tackle it, but I'm also like, it's really hard to compare us to Minneapolis sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think on that, you know, on that specific indicator, you can't disaggregate it down to the neighborhood level. I think on the rest of these, you know, like, indicators, we are, you know, able to, you know, if you look at, you know, what the McCouncil did on the racialized concentration areas of poverty, you know, East Side, Brocktown, North End, you know, Summit U, you know, these neighborhoods, you know, in particular, you know, are faring worse than comparable neighborhoods in Minneapolis, you know, just by the numbers. You know, we do know that, you know, on a number of different indicators when you really get down to sort of those neighborhood levels. And on that specific indicator, you know, we can't speak specifically.
Right. I'm just thinking when people get priced out of a city and move to the suburbs and the data changes because people have been forced out, it just makes it hard to compare. I just think it's this is, by the way, this is great. Like, this is great. This presentation is already totally captivating me. I think that's what's making me be like, how can we know more? So that's the problem with a good presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Councilmember. So the other one we're looking at is liquid asset poverty. So typically you see, you know, information on income poverty, but liquid asset poverty is really looking at status of, you know, financial security. And liquid asset poverty, that's a measure of the liquid savings. So mostly what do you have cash on hand that would hold to cover basic expenses for 3 months if you experience, you know, a sudden job loss, medical emergency, or some sort of financial crisis. And here you'll see St. Paul overall, 40% of residents are in that circumstance. And then HH of color, that's households of color, about two-thirds of our households of color, you know, are experiencing, you know, liquid asset poverty where, you know, if they lost their job, they would not have, you know, 3 months of cushion, you know, to really, you know, support, you know, themselves. So what we know is having savings helps families better weather those economic setbacks, and it can ensure that a household, you know, won't lose key wealth being vehicles such as a home or business, you know, during these, you know, financial setbacks. And research has showed that households with assets are much less likely to suffer these serious hardships, you know, in the event of some sort of economic, you know, indicator or emergency. The other one are households that don't have a checking or savings account. If you look here, 9% overall, and sort of the disparities here are actually quite stark, is in our white community in St. Paul, it's 3% don't have a checking or savings account compared to communities of color, which is 21%. As we're doing the analysis here, particularly within the African-American black community, this is, in fact, worse than Detroit, worse than St. Louis. We know that our city, in sort of how our residents experiencing banking, you know, can be, you know, an issue, and there's some, you know, good programming that is happening to, you know, address that, and we look to be in partnership with the folks who are. And then cost burden households. So this is just those who are paying 30% or more of their income on their rent or mortgage. So overall, 36%, and you see disproportionate between homeowners who tend to have higher incomes, you know, with renters. So about 51% are cost burdens, and we know that, you know, these take away money that could be, you know, saved toward investing, you know, our assets. And when they're When expenses exceed 30% of household income, that's classified, and that they're more at risk of, you know, eviction and homelessness, you know, as sort of the income declines. So for us, we're really thinking about this as how are our systems designed, you know? So there is sometimes our residents feel like they need to go around the circle when the path sometimes is easier to go through, go straight, you know, and have to sort of beat their own path. Or sometimes it's around going around the corner when that diagonal may be safer. And sometimes, you know, we put in, you know, keep off the grass and hope that that kind of technical, you know, approach will solve it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that people won't continue to go down, you know, their own beaten path. So for us in OFE, we're asking, who are we designing for? Who's at the table of designing? And how are we designing, right? And that sort of our resident experience doesn't always meet, you know, the system design. And we mean system design, that isn't just the city. You know, this is sort of the systems that have been set up around, whether it's the financial institutions, whether it's our financial capability partners, whether it's, you know, the housing and the developers and the landlords and, you know, all that. All those are systems that have been, you know, set up and designed. And for us, we're asking ourselves these questions. So for us on the who's designing, we'll be launching and have applications going out for Office of Financial Empowerment Community Council, which will sort of guide our priority setting and co-design our strategy levers. Beyond just a governing body, we're committed to, you know, human-centered design principles, which we used in College Bound St. Paul, which is a college savings account, which Ikram will talk about. How do we host forums, elevating community conversation and dialogue, and that radical hospitality. The how of design, as we think about our strategy levers, right now we've sort of identified nine different ways that as we look to move, you know, these different indicators is, you know, we're not going to program our way out. We're not going to policy our way out, right? So how do we hold the complexity of these issues by looking at a mix of strategies to move any single citywide indicator? And here you'll see a program policy system, narrative, research, convening, advancing community solutions, field building, you know, and aligned contributions. That doesn't mean we're going to do that on every single indicator, but where are going to be the highest leverage strategies for us to use. And right now our team you know, is looking at our factor analysis as we begin to prioritize you know, these which are the indicators that we're going to really be sort of deciding within our sphere of influence and moving from there.
Ms. Nanker.
Thank you. First of all, I agree with Council President Brenmo, and I really appreciate especially the specific indicators in the presentation. I think as we're starting new programs and putting ourselves out there financially, it's really great to see how we might be measuring success. And I know you said it wouldn't necessarily be all of these because that would be a full-time job in itself, but I appreciate seeing the focus on that. I heard you just say in terms of how to get the work done that it's not going to be a program or a policy and that it's a bunch of things, and I appreciate that. At the same time, I think there is a real sense of urgency to start doing specific things. We had a legislative advisory committee on poverty about a year and a half ago that came back with some very specific ideas related to some of the indicators you talked about, being unbanked, et cetera. I'm wondering if you have a sense as to what any of those specific actions might be, or if you can give us any more of a sense, or if it's really wait until the community council has had some time to meet and then they'll come up with things and we are not going to do anything until that. Just wondering how you're thinking about that.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a perfect segue into where we're headed next, and then I'll elaborate a little bit beyond just the three things. So the three things you see up here are going to be College Bound St. Paul, which is a college savings account program, working on fair housing you know, as a strategy. Right now we also got the CAFE grant, our city's addressing fines and fees, so looking at our fines and fees. Additionally, you'll see at the end of the presentation, you know, looking at how do we support scaling free tax prep clinics. So right now we know that about 5,000 St. Paul families aren't claiming their earned income tax credit and working family credit. So one's at the federal level, one's at the state level, which is leaving about $15 million on the table in refunds that people just aren't claiming that they have the right to. So that could be a potential strategy. You know, we're talking, you know, with Bank On and then you know, talking with Prepare and Prosper and Sunrise Bank, they have a FAIR initiative, which is really around getting people connected to financial institutions, reimagining what that works like, looks like. We've been talking with Village Financial Cooperative, which is a black-owned bank that's emerging, you know, in Minneapolis, but their service footprint is Ramsey and Hennepin County. We're looking at cooperative, economic cooperative strategies. So there's a number of things that we're looking at, and I think for us is, as we land on sort of these citywide, you know, indicators and sort of which one are going to be the priorities, that'll help us be sort of the vetting mechanism. So we're feeling really energized and comfortable by moving on these three things that we're moving on now. Then as we go through this prioritization process, you know, on the indicators, you know, then that will help sort out, you know, and really refine what are the specific strategies that we'll, you know, move on. Thanks. So with that said, I'm going to kick it over to Ikram. She's going to talk about College Bound St. Paul.
All right, thank you. Hello, council members. So my name is Akram, and I'm the College Savings Account Program Manager in our new Office of Financial Empowerment. And as you can see, there's our branding and logo, and it's very exciting and colorful. So College Bound St. Paul, a pathway for every child, family, and future. And essentially, it's our city's college savings account program. So I'm probably going to be using those interchangeably. But before I jump into the presentation, just wanted to give a quick shout out to some of our College Savings Account Task Force members who are in the audience. As you can see, just because they submitted their 90-page report doesn't mean that they're, you know, they're done. They continue to be supportive and are, you know, champions and cheerleaders for the program. So I just want to thank them for all of their time and energy. So for this presentation, the goal is to kind of give a brief overview of what College Savings Accounts are, looking at a national landscape, looking at some of the key program features for our St. Paul specific program, and then talking through some of the partnerships that we've had and that we will continue to build on. So for looking at the national landscape, college savings account by definition are long-term savings or investments accounts that help children build savings over time, mostly for post-secondary education. And when we say that, we mean anything after high school. And the way that they work is that an account is created and then those savings grow over time, but we'll go into that a little bit later. So this map here shows all of the CSA programs that currently exist at the city level and at the state level across the nation, and these numbers continue to grow. So as of December of 2018, there were 65 college savings account programs across the nation serving 457,000 children in 34 states and D.C., and this number continues to grow. So there are a lot of programs that are in design phase and implementation phase, such as ourselves, that aren't reflected in this program. So by the end of this year, I'll be curious to see what those numbers look like. And then just wanted to quickly highlight one of the programs that exist around the nation, kindergarten to college, which is the San Francisco College Savings Account Program. And they were the first universal automatic enrollment starting in kindergarten. And I was just at a presentation last week where I heard that their accounts are currently at $7.0 million in savings, of which $4.3 million were contributed by family members. And a majority of the children in that program are from lower-income communities, so we know that when provided the resources that our communities are eager to help support their children get into post-secondary education. And then the unique thing is, so obviously Minnesota is not currently on the map, but we're hopeful that when we launch our program in less than a year here, that we will help put Minnesota on the map. And College Bound St. Paul will be the first at-birth citywide program in the nation, so a lot of programs are looking to us as a model to follow. So just to provide some context and background on CSA programs, what are they, how do they work, and what benefits do they have? So as I said already, college savings accounts are usually a savings or investments accounts that grow over time. And the way that they usually work is an account is open on behalf of a child either at birth or at kindergarten by specific entities such as a city, a state, or a nonprofit. And then those accounts grow over time through bonuses, incentives, and family contributions. And then the student is able to use those funds for a post-secondary education of their choice, meaning college, university, training programs, etc. And then they attend college or post-secondary education and graduate. And college savings accounts have been found to have a huge impact on community members, both at the participant level but also community level. So one of the studies found that they help increase college attendance and graduation. So the specific study found that for children from low-income communities, if they have just less than $500 set aside for post-secondary education, that they're 3 times more likely to go to college and 4 times more likely to graduate. So we know that this really is a huge game changer for our communities that really need this most. And then another impact they have is they help boost parents' expectation for their children's future. They also help improve the social emotional development in children, which is also correlated with educational achievement later in life. And last but not least, they help improve maternal mental health. So the study found that for children whose mothers had a CSA program, that they had less depressive symptoms. And so this shows us that this is not just about the children who are in the program. It really is about the family and looking at them as a whole system. And it is why our city is taking a multi-generation approach, which is why all the work that we do within OFE is going to be helping to support families in our program. And then, so why College Bound St. Paul? And hopefully with the impacts that we already talked about, it helps answer the question why it's important for our city. But to talk a little more specifically, college savings accounts and this program itself is will help us change the odds for our children. We know that a lot of children in St. Paul, specifically children of color, face a lot of challenges around financial insecurity and educational attainment. And so this is our opportunity to ensure that, you know, children in the program, specifically those from historically under-resourced communities, have the opportunity to have a meaningful participation in the program and to get a jump start on a successful future. And this graphic right here just shows how it's really a community-based program, even though, you know, so there's children who are born next year will get an account, but that it's a life cycle, and it requires all of us supporting those children. And then for design process, so how did we end up designing our program? So definitely was not done in a room here at City Hall. It was community-owned, community-designed, community-driven. And so as you know, about this time last year, the mayor convened a 50-plus member task force that was tasked with bringing back a report by the end of the year to design the program. What is our specific program going to look like? We know that there are a lot of great models from San Francisco and St. Louis and a lot of other cities and states, but we wanted to make sure that our program met the specific needs of our specific children and families, because we know that those aren't always aligned across the nation. So the task force members met and talked about a lot of different things, such as, you know, birth records and how we're going to be able to get that, the types of account vehicle we'd be able to use, and then, you know, importantly, how we can use the CSA program as a tool to help leverage other programs and services that already exist in our city. So it's not a standalone program. It really is meant to be integrated into already existing programs. So on top of the task force, we had the task force held a focus group with grasstop stakeholders to think through how the program can be specifically integrated into their current programs and services, as well as the community engagement sessions we did with over 145 members of our community, and mostly young mothers and fathers. And this graph right here shows, so just to reiterate, our program will be launching January 1st of 2020. And beginning then, all children who are born as residents in St. Paul would be enrolled in the program with a $50 seed deposit. And within just the first 4 years of the program will be enrolling about 21 children in St. Paul. So it's a rapidly growing 21,000. So it's going to be growing pretty quickly, but of course that means the children as well as their families. And then in designing the program, there were three key values that were that the task force was rooted in. So every decision they made sure that they met, that it met these three values of accessible, equitable, and sustainable. And some of the key program features that they have recommended is a universal inclusive eligibility, which means that all children will be eligible for the program up to their sixth birthday to enroll for those who move in. And then there's automatic enrollment. So that removes the barrier of children having families having to find out about the program and filling out like a 10-page form to enroll their child, because we know that that's where barriers begin to get created. So it's automatic enrollment, and parents can opt out as they would like. And then the other thing that the task force had a lot of conversation around was the flexibility of the use of the program funds. And so for the funds, they wanted to make it as flexible as possible in terms of post-secondary education. So what they recommend is that the funds can be used for post-secondary education or related costs, because we know that sometimes it's the filling the gap is outside of just tuition that students need to pay for, and then that they could be used for four-year colleges and technical school and training and anything that falls into really advancing themselves.
Ms. Naker.
Thank you. You may have mentioned this already and I missed it, but do we have a financial partner established where the savings will be kept?
So good question, council member. And we do not have a financial partner yet, but we're actually in the process of finalizing an RFI to get a financial institution at the table.
Yeah. And so it would be one financial partner where everything would...
So as what the task force recommended is that they kind of left it open. They said either one or more, because there are positives to both. And so I think that will depend on the proposals that we get back and what that process looks like, but most likely it'll be one, but we'll see. And then the program administration, so the task force also recommended that the program be administered through the Office of Financial Empowerment, so that's why we are embedded within this office, and we have the staff, myself, and then the director, Munir. And then for ongoing community engagement, Munir already touched on it, but we're going to have an OFE Community Council, and so there'll be a group within that group that helps to advise on the college bouncing call to make sure that community input is incorporated as we continue to develop and build and tweak the program, because we're still in the beginning stages of implementation. And then for...
I'm just going to be... Hold on one second. Mr. Tolbert had a question.
Yeah. Who will qualify?
I'm sorry?
Who will... How do you qualify for the 50 to get the account?
So to get the account, it would be for all children born as a resident of St. Paul beginning January 1st of 2020.
So their mother lives in St. Paul, or they're born in a St. Paul hospital?
One of their parents lives in St. Paul. It doesn't matter where they're born. They could be born in a different city as long as they're a resident of St. Paul.
Okay.
And so it's on residency.
What do the parents have to do to get the kids the thing, or is it automatic? Or, I mean, how does that work?
Yep, so it's automatic enrollment, so they don't have to do anything. So we'll be getting birth records from Ramsey County Public Health and the Minnesota Department of Health. So as soon as we get the birth record, we'll open an account for them, and then they'll have a specific period of time to opt themselves out if they would like. But it's automatic enrollment, so they don't have to take any action to be enrolled into the program.
We can legally open a bank account for somebody without their... I mean, obviously, a child that's born isn't able to consent to it, but that's legal?
So these will be in one large custodial account that's owned by, like, the city, for example, and then the children will be named the beneficiary.
Okay. And how do you opt out?
So they would, in the welcome kits that we send home, parents will have an opportunity to opt out that way. And so since we are in implementation phase, we have yet to figure out, you know, what that form looks like. But what a lot of programs do is they send some type of communication either through mail or, you know, other ways of getting messages to families, and then give them a specific period of time to opt out of the program. And, of course, they'd be able to opt out at any point.
Mr. Tolbert, following up.
Would a person be able to go back in future dates and be able to to claim that they were not given an account when they deserved one? Is there a process for that?
So not per se, but the eligibility that the task force recommended is that it would be any children born or they have up to their sixth birthday to enroll into the program. So if a child is 4 years old and moves into the city after 2020, then they'll have an opportunity to enroll into the program.
Okay, so anybody who – so what if a child is born here and after a month moves to Bemidji? Are they always qualified for the $50?
So as long as, you know, depending on when we get their birth records, which is probably going to be quarterly, they're going to be enrolled, and we know that a lot of our families are transient, and so the accounts will probably be open for a specific period of time. And then if we know that the families will move at, like, are moving out, then they won't be able to take, like, the seed deposit, for example, if those are public dollars. But any deposits that they've made on their own, they would be able to take that with.
Mr. Tao.
Thank you. Curious, so this is different than like a 529 account?
Yes, so this is different from a 529, and that's one of the things that the task force actually talked a lot about in determining the account vehicle. It was either to use a 529 or it was to use a savings account through a financial institution. And the reason that the task force decided to go with a savings account versus a 529 is that because 529s are less accessible to our community members. They don't have physical bank locations that families would be able to go and make cash deposits. And we know that that's an accessibility issue because a lot of our communities of color will want to physically go and make that $5 deposit or whatever it may be. And then the 529s also require a Social Security number or ITIN, either when you're creating the account or when you're taking the funds out at the end. So that also poses some barriers for some of our community members.
Okay. And then is this the parents or the participant, when we make a contribution to, is that tax deductible for us?
For the parents?
For the parents or for any members of the community that wants to contribute to this?
That's a good question, and I will have to check in with someone and get back to you on that.
Okay. Another follow-up.
Yeah.
So if we put this into a bank, what happens if the bank goes bankrupt or something like that?
That is also a great question. And so hopefully the bank definitely doesn't go bankrupt, but that's also another question that we'll definitely follow up with our treasurer, Mike Solomon, who I think is also in the room to help us think through some solutions that we can put in place in worst case scenarios.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. And then just another question. What about young people who, when, you know, in the beginning they want to go to college, but then they find out that they want to go and join the buildings and trade or be a carpenter, what happened to their fund?
They would be able to use the funds for expenses that might come with that. So, if, you know, like, because depending on if those trainings cost money or for supplies and things like that, they would be able to use the funds. So it's not restricted just to colleges and universities. It's all trainings across the board.
So when they withdraw, would that be a lump sum, or how does that work?
So since we are still in implementation phase, we haven't really talked through too much of what that process looks like when they're withdrawing at the end. But the way that other programs have talked about it now, because no program is currently running that has got to that stage, but it would probably be a lump sum. But that's something that we still have to decide on.
Okay. And then what about folks who, young people who, you know, they might be a might be into coding in high school, and then they decide they want to open up their own business at the end of high school. Can they use that money to start their own business?
So, yeah, that was part of the discussion. And even to start a business, that will require some training or some investments that you'll have to make into things. And so the task force decided that they would be able to use for trainings as well. And for starting a business, kind of depends. Like, I think if they want to use it towards some training that will help them and build that business, then they'd be able to use that. But I know that they also didn't want to make it too flexible where funds can just be used to start a business when that's maybe not exactly what you're doing. But definitely can be thought partners in really solidifying that further.
Sure. And I brought that up because I think the experience that we see is that typically millennials and people of color have a hard time accessing capital mm-hmm. to start their own business. And mostly banks just make money available to folks who already have money. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we hope you all would consider that this is an option for folks who just want to use that money to start their own business as well, because it's still investing in St. Paul.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So with my colleague's permission and an eye on the time, we do need to be done here at 11:30. And I think what you're hearing is there's a ton of interest around this table yes. in a city role in supporting our young people. So this is exciting. And maybe we need a special policy session just on CSAs to dive in more. But I would maybe suggest that we wrap up this quickly and move to fair housing, because that's a whole other.
Yes. All right. We'll accelerate through that and just end it. We have a whole lot of private, public-private, you know, partnership support. Many of our partners, several of them, you know, are in the room, but everyone you see on the screen here has been engaged in the process in some way, shape, or form, and will continue to be. So with that said, we'll kick it over to Kirsten to talk a little bit about fair housing.
Thank you. Good morning, council members. My name is Kirsten Birch, and I'm the fair housing coordinator in OFE. When you're out, I'll just say next slide when I'm ready to move on. But the way that OFE is really seeing our fair housing work shape up in our office is leading citywide strategy around affirmatively furthering fair housing. And we are looking at kind of four core categories of work, and those are preservation and production, tenant protections, education and engagement, and then enforcement and compliance. And I'll talk more about those in just a moment. I just want to briefly touch on kind of the work that preceded the creation of this position. So back in 2015, St. Paul, as well as Minneapolis, were named in a HUD complaint around their analysis of impediments in furthering fair housing work. And the city entered into a voluntary agreement. There weren't any findings, but a voluntary agreement to really dig into looking at what our current practices are around fair housing and how we can take a deeper dive to do better work around that. And so one of the first things that happened was the FIC worked on an addendum to the analysis of impediments that really took those impediments and took a deeper dive to strategize around some goals, both regionally and for St. Paul specific as an entitlement jurisdiction, on what we could do to really further fair housing in all of our practices. City Council also helped to form that fair housing work group that was an internal group of city employees that also took that analysis of impediments and strategized around what the city could do to make sure that all of our policies and practices have another additional fair housing lens on our work. And then Council passed a resolution that really had a robust amount of concepts to explore around things that we could do in the short run and in the long term to really continue implementing fair housing strategies across the board. And one of those things was the creation of this position to really kind of lead that work and drive that work. Next slide. So as we're thinking about strategy development, there are a few key things that we want to make sure we're really focusing in on. The first is really a deep awareness of what the issues actually are. You know, what are we solving for? What impact does this concern have on the housing landscape, and who are the stakeholders for these issues? Then we can start moving on to thinking about what our solutions are. What results are we looking for? What impact will these results have on the housing landscape or the way that we change the housing landscape? And then what strategy or mix of strategies can we use to get the results that we want? And then we can take action. Always thinking about implementation, what's within our sphere of influence at the city that we can kind of move on in the more immediate space, and then who do we need to partner with, or what relationships do we need to develop to make sure that these strategies will work? What concepts need to be piloted in order to prove that they will actually change the housing landscape? How will we measure and define success? And then is this something that is scalable? Another part of that strategy is going to be the coordination among various city departments. We can really see our work intersecting with almost all of them, but these are some of the key partners in making sure that the strategy that we come up with is going to be a strong strategy that we can implement across the board, and ensuring that anything that we are thought partners in making sure that we are really thinking through the way that these are going to work for the long term. I've been working closely with the housing director and PED and really learning more about what their housing strategies are and what their priorities and goals are, and working closely on how fair housing aligns with the Housing Trust Fund strategy. And I also just recently went to D.C. for a fair housing leadership training with Jeff Martin from HERO, and that really reaffirmed how St. Paul is taking a proactive approach to be a leader in this space and to be more proactive in terms of how we are looking at fair housing and the disparate impact that it may have on our communities. So of those four core areas of work, briefly just looking at how we are looking at preservation and production, that's really going to be primarily supporting PED and the Housing Trust Fund strategy, ensuring that the investments that we're making going forward support equitable access to housing choice and place-based assets, creating pathways to affordable homeownership, prioritizing the production of family-sized units and family housing, and then really thinking about, as those units are being created, who are they affordable to? We know that one of our steepest housing gaps are for residents that are at or below 30% AMI, so really doing all that we can to prioritize the preservation and the creation of units that are deeply affordable at that level. The next bucket is tenant protection. So we'll be looking at a slate of tenant protection ordinances that'll help to reduce the impact of criminal credit and rental histories, addressing the upfront cost of renting a home and purchasing a home, thinking about incentive structures to increase access to housing for those who have been traditionally blocked out of housing opportunities, working on anti-displacement concepts tied to evictions, condemnations, and gentrification, and then creating a tenant bill of rights. Looking at education and engagement, we also will be forming a Fair Housing Advisory Council that will work closely with our OFE Community Council to really support and drive this work. The OFE will continue to prioritize community engagement and the development of concepts and policies. We'll be working with HERO to support educational opportunities for tenants, landlords, and community members to really deepen our understanding of the history of fair housing, what our rights and responsibilities are, and how we can really try to combat NIMBYism. And then we'll move on to compliance and enforcement. So that's really going to be working with DSI to ensure that our certificate of occupancy requirements, inspections, and condemnation processes are in alignment with our fair housing efforts, building partnerships that are really going to support tenants knowing and exercising their rights, and then thinking about how we can implement fair housing testing or mystery shopping or any other proactive ways to measure compliance with any policies or concepts that we want to move forward on, rather than waiting for the harm to be done or the discrimination to take place for us to be in a reactive position, but really getting out there and ensuring that people know up front this is what our expectations are. And as we think through investments that we're making, these are the expectations we are setting for anybody that the city is going to be working with. And so in 2019, I've been spending a lot of time engaging around kind of getting the housing landscape of the city right now, and we'll be engaging with you all around the development of this fair housing policy agenda. Hopefully we will pass that by the end of summer, and that fair housing policy agenda is really going to drive the work of our Fair Housing Advisory Council, the citywide strategy that we'll be building, and then any budget considerations that we need to make in terms of what we would like to pilot or move forward on.
Well done. Mr. Tolbert.
Thank you all. I think this was helpful. On the fair housing front, I'm glad that you're going to spend the first part just kind of getting the landscape. One of the things that I tried to push on when we went through the fair housing plan and came back with it is there's a lot of partners who we actually give money to, SMRLs and others, that do a lot of this work and do it really well. And I don't know if we fully have accounted or appreciated for the work that they're doing and how that, you know, we don't need to recreate the wheel on all these programs. SMRLs might be the best at tenant protections or whatever that might be. And so my suggestion would just be to make sure to reach out to all them and really understand all that they do, because we give SMRLs $300,000 or more a year. That number's probably not right, but it's somewhere in that area. And so I would just suggest making sure that so we don't have to be duplicative at the city when our partners are already doing it.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Tao.
Thank you. This is really important, impressive work, and I'm just curious, as part of the, you know, we just recently had a session on Heading Home Ramsey and homelessness, so I'm just curious, what role does Ramsey County play in this, because it's we're working with the same population?
Absolutely. We certainly know that the city of St. Paul can't solve for this housing crisis on our own, so we will be looking at strategies and ways that we can partner with Ramsey County to kind of build a strategy that is going to take a broader approach than just within the confines of the city. And then I was also at that policy session with Heading Home Ramsey, and really look at our work as being a little more upstream in that conversation. We really want to focus our efforts on prevention of displacement and then increasing access. And so how can we kind of mitigate and reduce those instances of crisis before we get to that point? And so really trying to partner with Heading Home Ramsey and all the community partners that are doing work in that space to make sure that we're talking to each other and we're understanding the barriers as deeply as we're able to, so that we can really use that to influence the policy and programs that we are looking to build at the city level. But certainly, as housing providers and supportive housing providers, there will be collaboration with the city.
Thank you. Another follow-up question would be, in the diagram with the different partners, are the developers, are they part of this conversation?
Absolutely. I would, community was kind of broadly stated in that, but I would view community as community members, housing providers, housing developers, property owners in general.
Ms. Prince.
Yeah, Ms. Birch, this is a great presentation, and I'm so glad you're here and that all of you are doing the work you're doing, and it's super important for the communities that I represent. One thing I wanted to say on the tenant protection ordinances. I think so much work has been done by the Housing Justice Center. City of Minneapolis has already passed those. We have committed to them in our housing policy resolution that we passed last July. And I think those are things that we could just get ready and do right out of the box. I mean, the 90-day notice of sale, the just cause eviction, the tenant bill of rights. I mean, those are all things. Community Stabilization Program has been doing such good work in that area that I just want you to know that I'm happy to partner immediately and just get those out of the gate. So,
absolutely.
So thank you for your work. And super, it's the most important thing.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson, and then we're going to wrap.
I promise a 1 minute. thank you. I just have 2 points. One is that I've been thinking a lot lately about the connection between energy costs and fair housing and just seeing how our cost burden households are in part cost burden because the cost of utilities and just having, you know, basic bills every month pile up is really high. And so I'm really interested in figuring out how to link those things better in our tenant protections work coming up and all the programs that we're working on. And the other is that I'm just appreciating and really sitting with the slide that said affordable for whom. And I think that question is really important because the area median income, which is what the formulas all kind of predicate themselves on, is so much higher than our city median income. Like Minnesota Housing Partnership says it's hundreds of dollars a month in rent out of reach when you really crunch the numbers for what's real for people in our community. So thank you for asking the real questions, and I feel that this council is wholeheartedly, you know, excited to work on this with you and make a dent in some of these issues. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. So if you're not hearing it loudly enough around the table, I think we are chomping at the bit to pass policies in support of the fair housing agenda, and I think we have been ever since we passed a resolution in July, but we wanted to wait for you to do it in concert with you and your team, and I'm extremely excited about the work ahead, but I would say get us some legislation as soon as we can so we can start getting this done. Thank you so much for the presentation. I'm sorry we ran out of time, and for the council, we are adjourned until 3:30.